Hello, people. Welcome back to the show. Rafe Kelly has finally agreed to come on the podcast. Amazing man. He is the founder of Evolve Move Play, beautiful organization over in the West Coast of America. And they are one of the premier natural movement teaching organizations in the world. They focus on evolutionary approaches to movement practice. But this conversation really dives into maps of meaning, what I'd call just really anchoring us to the things that we are a part of and we create in this life through the lens of evolution, and nothing makes sense unless it is viewed that way. Rafe is someone who gets to the root causes of real systemic problems, and I respect his stance on a lot of stuff. So I hope you enjoy. He's an amazing man with a curious energy that he brings to conversations. I definitely say check out his conversations with John Vervaeke. And we provide a little bit of context to those in this conversation. It's definitely a flavor of that. And it's really around connecting with things that do bring us closer to our lives, and how to develop virtues and how to ponder big ideas and bring them into and integrate them into reality. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. One thing I need to talk to you about is the men's retreats I've got coming up this year. I've got three happening, one in April, one in June, one in August. And these retreats are a way to get clearer on your direction as a man. They are intimate experiences, so they're limited spaces. And what we really do here is bring in all the practices that have helped and supported me over the years. In April, I've got a man called Kevin O'Neill coming to support, and he's going to be guiding some breathwork practices, and we're going to be doing hot and cold exposure. We are going to be diving deep into the inner most challenging aspects of our lives, bringing it to the table so we can work through it. They're called Facing the Shadow, and it's an opportunity for you to carve out some time for yourself so you can show up better as a man for yourself and for those around you. So please check out the link in the description of the podcast. You can head over to the website. Just go to menofearth.co.uk and you can find out how you can bring yourself to one of these spaces this year. They are powerful, they're transformational, and we'll set up a call and we can find out if this is something you can benefit from. So applications are on the website. Awesome. Now over to the sponsors. Are you a coffee drinker? I am. I love it. It's one of the best things of my day. I love looking forward to sitting down with that warm brew, and I often use it to dive into some work or facilitate focus or connection with someone I share it with. So surely I should be prioritizing the best kind of coffee. And since I transitioned to Exhale, a lot has changed. All coffee, as we know, is not created equal. It's in fact one of the most sprayed crops in the world and has been renowned to be full of mycotoxins. But as I said, I think we all know that, right? My good friend Alex in 2020 set out to make the world's healthiest coffee without compromising on taste and sustainability. He dived into all the science and actually found that it is such an amazing superfood. They prioritize farming, sourcing, roasting. It's organic, it's specialty grade, freshly roasted and ground, lab tested over 9 times, and tested for and free from molds, yeast, heavy metals, packed full of antioxidants and polyphenols, which have been linked to reduce inflammation, heart disease, and boost brain function. If that's not enough to convince you to try Exhale, let me just add they are B Corp and members of the Soil Association. They have an impressive blog, weekly newsletter that they pack loads of useful health-related tips into. Go check them out. Link is in the description. What are you waiting for? Go, go, go. Use code CGP or click the link in the description for £10 off your first bag on a full flexible subscription. You can cancel at any time if you don't notice the difference. 450 bags of coffee, 30 cups for just £8. Beautiful. So the further we get away from nature and what's natural, the more disease, illness that occurs. I'm sure you'd agree this is no different when thinking about your feet, which we often don't think about. What are we putting our feet into? They are the only thing that's connected to the ground at all times. They affect balance, posture, strength, mobility, all of the above. Now, preventing your risk of injury might be exposing your feet to varieties of different ground, different surfaces. Now, we do this in the gym. We stress our bodies to adapt. It's the same process when you're thinking about your feet. And if you care about your health, you'll definitely try some Wild Soul sandals. Yes More Friends of the Podcast. Tom and James started this company last year. They have handcrafted some of the world's finest sandals, UK produced from animal friendly materials and shipped in recycled and plastic free packaging. Now, I could talk about the benefits of footwear all day. These are close to as being barefoot as possible. I don't know anything else I would put on my feet that I would wear to so many different occasions. Wear them in the warmth, in the cold, and it allows your feet to breathe. Like, they are the closest thing you can get to bare feet. Now, of course, you might have heard of Vivo Barefoot, but they're nowhere near being barefoot. These are Wild Soul sandals, and they are the closest thing you can get to being barefoot. When you're not barefoot, wear Wild Soul sandals. They have a zero drop sole that is thin and flexible to allow your feet to truly feel the ground beneath you, like millions of years of evolution wants you to. For form and function, you can actually select the size of the thickness of the sandal on the website. And the biggest functional difference between these and a standard pair of flip-flops, not that they should even be compared, but the adjustable straps hold your feet secure so your toes don't have to constantly grip part of the sole. The wide toe box and lack of constraint allows your feet to expand as much as they need to when you put weight on them. I know Tom hasn't taken his off for the last 2 years. He's never worn anything else. Use code CDP10 at checkout for 10% off. All the links in the description. Go get yourself a pair. It will change your life. Men cannot be men, much less good or heroic men, unless their actions have meaningful consequences to people they truly care about. Strength requires an opposing force. Courage requires risk. Mastery requires hard work. Honor requires accountability to other men. Without these things, we are little more than boys playing at being men. And there is no weekend retreat or mantra or half-assed rite of passage that can change that. A rite of passage must reflect a real change in status and responsibility for it to be anything more than theater. No reimagined manhood of convenience can hold its head high so long as the earth remains the tomb of our ancestors. How did that land? Like, what stood out to you?
We need to fundamentally transform ourselves by facing something that's genuinely challenging in order to grow into manhood. We can easily sort of try to LARP our way through in a way that doesn't actually serve the purpose.
Yeah.
I think that's the themes that popped up for me out of it.
Yes. There's another quote that goes something like, the modern day tragedy is that men lack opportunities to become who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it just lands so deeply. Because without the environment, without the circumstances, without the accountability, really, like, we are humans that need some level of resistance to become something else. And it's those opportunities that have forged us into who we are over time. So it's looking through the eyes of evolution.
Sebastian Junger quote I really like, which is that what human beings like best is being a integral part of a small group struggling to survive. And it kind of gets at some of those same themes, the idea that we need some kind of struggle in order to organize our lives towards, and that it's given meaning by its connection to other people. So we have to have the people that we're struggling alongside and for and with, as well as the struggle itself. And he said, you know, this is what we evolved within. So, you know, that's why we struggle when we don't have it. Junger, of course, did lots of work on soldiers in the Afghanistan war. Mm-hmm. And he looked at PTSD symptoms when people came back, and he kind of developed the thesis that a lot of it actually had more to do with the environments they came home to than the trauma of the environments they left. It was the lack of deep connection that actually made readaptation to the sort of civilian world so hard on them.
Have you read the Disaster Diaries?
I haven't. No, I'm not familiar.
It's cool. It's about what happens in disaster, generally natural disasters, but also you could relate it to times in World War II where it was arguably the best time to live in community, like the safest and the most connected, because in times of disaster, it forces people to band together. And it's no surprise that this happens, but why does it take that, you know? Why does it take that to bring a state? When COVID happened, there was a part of me that was really ready for this. And it was a part of me that really came alive. And it was the part of me that I feel like most days I'm training for. I'm sure you've heard that.
Oh, for sure. I think a lot of people felt like, hey, this is a moment when, you know, like in méthode naturelle, the old French sort of physical education method that really was the first kind of natural movement method that emphasized, you know, going barefoot, shirtless, and climbing trees, and a broad sort of holistic approach to movement. Their motto was "Être fort pour être utile." Forgive my French, but that means be strong to be useful. And a lot of people in the parkour community have also adopted that as an ethos. And so there was this moment when it felt like, in the face of a global disaster, there was a chance to actually offer strength to the problem in a way that was meaningful. And, you know, for a lot of people, that was quite energizing. I don't know that it actually worked out that way, but it was energizing at the time.
Yeah, it's energizing. But we can create our own reality, right, from how we view things. And if we're viewing it as if we're training for something bigger or to be ready when it comes, then that can always be the case. I guess that's the martial arts kind of ethos as well, isn't it?
That's one thing. You know, the quote, you know, you create your own reality. That one always drove me crazy. My dad would say that when I was a kid. And, you know, it'd be like, you know, basically, dad, you're being kind of a fuck up, right? And he'd be like, you know, well, you create your own reality. And I'd be like, our dissatisfaction with you is not because we're creating our own reality. You're creating the reality in which you're cheating on your wife, in which, you know, you're not showing up for your kids, in which, you know, people resent you because of your behavior. That's the reality you're creating. So there is the way in which we create our own reality. And then there's also a way, the other quote is, reality is what doesn't go away when you don't believe in it.
Yeah.
And so there's this aspect of reality as like something that smacks you in the face. Right? I think the word object actually literally means to smack together. Right? So the objective aspect of reality is the part that, you know, if I throw a ball in your face, there's no amount of, you know,
will
manifesting that's going to stop it from bruising your facial bones, right? So,
but your belief around why the ball hit you will shape your perspective. Your response. Yeah.
So there's there's these different aspects of reality, the subjective and the objective, and what my mentor John Verveke calls the transjective, right? Which is the relationships that are real, that exist between between the agent, you know, in the arena, or between the different agents in the arena. And that those are actually real in the same way that, you know, an object is real. And that's something that our sort of the Cartesian epistemology doesn't really land for us. And then postmodern epistemology just rejects reality completely. But there is actually a way in which there's a reality to patterns of being. And those, you know, they don't actually just go away because we try to manifest them in some other way either. Excuse me. Sorry. Lots of sniffles today.
So good. Yeah. It's the classic, the dishes aren't going to wash themselves, kind of. You're not going to, you get, there's going to be things you have to do in life.
You're manifesting the dishes washing themselves, probably taking advantage of somebody in your life.
Yeah, I feel like there's a love affair happening with you and John. I've been loving deep diving into your conversations.
Yeah, John is one of my dearest friends and, you know, my most important intellectual mentor for sure.
How long have you known him?
I believe we met at the beginning of 2019 online. And then he came out in person in 2022 to Return of the Source.
Yeah, I feel like that was a big moment for him.
It was a pretty remarkable thing for, you know, a 60 some, you know, academic with Meniere's disease to get himself into this movement event and show up and participate as fully as he possibly could. And yeah, it was beautiful,
What
beautiful
was
night.
his why? Or did he just want to spend some time in person with you and then didn't really know what he was getting into?
He knew what he was getting into. I invited him. I wanted him to be there. I felt like it was really important for him to really experience the whole thing. And he accepted my invitation, and he was going to come the previous year, and then it fell through because of COVID. And then he came in 2022, and he has a real ethos of participant research, right? So when he believes in something, when it makes sense to him, he, sorry. Forgot to turn my phone off. One second. Good. So, like, you know, he's doing circling, he's doing authentic relating, he's doing you know, he's done Jungian therapy and internal family systems therapy and you know, an enormous amount of different things, right? If he sees that the research looks good and the theory looks good and there's a way for him to participate in it so he can understand the stuff that he's trying to share into the world, he wants to do it. I think that's my observation of him and what he's told me.
Yeah, that is one thing with your work that I could rely on it. When I found more authentic, grounded things online, and we can talk about this kind of technological, as you're being pulled to your phone, this technological struggle. It's so good. Like it's this thing that we always have to like side with or convince ourselves that like there's reason to do it. And it's such a dichotomy even for me, like contributing to the content that seems to be greater in en masse. But in terms of finding your work through the means of technology and being able to pull up one of your podcasts and listen and dive into things that felt really connected, I could always rely on it to speak truth and to speak to me and ground me when things weren't making sense in my world, where there was no one around that I felt like I could trust. There was always that pull back to your work and like Tony Riddle, who's here in the UK, you might know of. Like it's rooted in natural ways of living and being. And that for me is the one thing I look and I means test everything through that lens. Of like, how does this make sense in the eyes of evolution? How to move, how to breathe, how to go to the toilet, all of these things, how to wear sh like walk on the earth. And it was always so reliable. And yeah, it just always felt grounding and safe to just understand myself through that work.
Yeah, I mean, I think self-knowledge is one of the most empowering things that we have. And, you know, I mentioned earlier the idea of like a Cartesian epistemology, and how it separates the individual from like full continuity with the sensed world. And then the postmodernism tends to sort of collapse towards solipsism, where there's really only the experiencing agent and everything else is constructed, and really it's constructed within within this deeply corrupted, you know, because it's all about power, right? The whole ethos of the world is interpreted through power. I can't remember who coined this term, but there's the hermeneutics of suspicion. And Marx and the postmodernists, they give us the hermeneutics of suspicion, where we're always looking for the subtext beneath things. We're always looking to deconstruct things. And that that again, it sort of radically isolates us from the very things that could give us deep self-knowledge. So when we take on the simple assumption that there is a nature, right, in some way, I was listening to a conversation between Daniel Schmachtenberger, Ian McGilchrist, and John Verveke, and they were talking about how we have separated nature into the environment. So an environment is something that you are within, right? But it's not something that you are of. Whereas nature literally means what we arise from. So there's an origin point to the individual human being. And when we take seriously those origins, we have just simply a stronger grounds to understand ourselves and to be able to guide our actions towards something like the good, the true, and the beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, a lot of stuff within the paleo natural movement sphere, it ends up being pretty shallowly thought out. There's like a sort of the fallacy of appeal to nature. Because it's natural, it's good. And that's not always the case. But it, at least it gives you a beginning of a grounding, right? Literally, like the ground. What is your relationship to the ground? Mm-hmm. And it gives you the sense, the awareness that your selfhood is continuous with the sensed world. And that's incredibly profound.
Yeah. I mean, the only way you can detach from nature is with your words, right? And I guess your beliefs.
Yeah. Well, so it's that gets to the squishy part of when we talk about nature, right? Because we tend to sort of set up this contrast class between natural and unnatural, right? So barefoot is natural, you know, wearing shoes is unnatural, or, you know, this way of running on the balls of your feet is natural, and heel striking is unnatural. Mm-hmm. We can end up demonizing all sorts of variations in how people move or behave that are actually maybe natural. And so then we can sort of point out that, well, actually everything that we think of as unnatural must arise from the natural world.
Yeah.
So there's no clean dividing point between, you know, so you can climb a tree. That seems very natural, right? You can cut a branch off of the tree and then you can use it as a walking stick. Is that natural? Right? You turn it into fire. Is that natural? You harden a point on it and turn it into a spear. Is that natural? I mean, it all came from nature. So the way that I think about it is there's that unnatural is really not a coherent thing. But what we can think about is artificial, or that's one layer that we can think about. So things that are the product of human artifice, that's often what we mean when we think unnatural, right? A skyscraper is unnatural because we made it.
I feel like
because
people do this with drugs mainly to justify their consumption.
Sure. I mean, but we, you know, there's so many throughputs and so many ways that we have to extract things from the kind of inherent processes of the natural world that go into creating a skyscraper, that it requires immensely more human artifice than a sharpened stick. And then in some sense, that means immensely more culture, right? There's a whole culture that has to be built to create the supply chains that allow a skyscraper to be produced. Now, one of the ways that I think about that then is also that as we create things through artifice, we are actually shifting the environments that we exist within. And we are moving into environments that are increasingly, or relationships that are increasingly evolutionarily novel. So human beings can climb a tree, find a nice sharp, nice branch, chop it off, turn into a sharp stick, and throw it. And that's actually the human superpower. Like, people talk a lot about, you know, we're born to run, and we can run really far. But the human advantage in running is primarily something that exists within arid environments that are hot enough. So a human being can easily, you know, outrun a big ruminant animal in a desert. But human beings, you know, don't have high success just running down moose in bogs in the Arctic. And we definitely can't keep up with wolves in those kinds of environments. So if you look at the cross-cultural literature, only about 6% of tribes, and, you know, take, obviously, it's statistics cited on the internet without a citation, so take it with a grain of salt. But the last time I looked at the ethnologue, I believe that it was about 6% of hunter forager tribes use persistence hunting. So the argument isn't that modern hunter foragers are persistence hunters. It's that we see this behavior and we see adaptations to it, and we think, okay, maybe that was really important at one stage of our evolution, but it's a hypothesis. And, you know, well, a human versus a dog, a human versus a horse, it's not, you know, human beings cannot run the Iditarod.
Cannot run what, sorry?
The Iditarod.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the Iditarod is?
No.
It's this multi-day sled race in Alaska.
Okay.
And the sled dogs who run it are some of the most absurd athletes in, you know, like, if you look at the research, adapt to these things, it's absurd.
Our capacity for endurance, though, is pretty comprehensive in terms of, in relation to other animals, right?
Well, like I said, it's environmentally dependent. Like I said, a human being can't run the Iditarod.
No.
If you race humans and horses, it's kind of like a mix. Depends on the environment. Yeah. But the thing that a human being can do that nothing else can do is throw hard enough to kill something fairly easily and with accuracy.
Yeah, manipulate.
A healthy adult male can throw a baseball about 50 miles per hour. You know, a chimpanzee throws maybe 30 miles per hour. And they can't aim at a moving object, so far as we know. So they can't throw with nearly the same accuracy as we can. So this is kind of a long ramble, but the reason that I bring this up is because throwing is actually incredibly important to human nature. It is our superpower, right? We don't have claws. We don't have canines. We don't have particularly thick hides. We're not really fast runners. You know, we're kind of vulnerable as far as, you know, apex predators. But basically, we can project a sharp stick into an animal from 20 yards away. And that made us the most powerful predator on Earth. But here's the interesting thing. Throwing is really hard on human beings. If you look at the injury rates of pitchers, they're through the roof.
Yeah.
Quarterbacks. Now, human beings have been brachiating animals for maybe 20 million years, hanging from trees and swinging. Turns out swinging and hanging is incredibly healthy for the shoulder. A lot of the impingements we have in the shoulder are actually because it's like a missing movement nutrient.
Yeah, in the
Just
back.
hang. Okay. So because we can hang, we were pre-adapted to the capacity to throw. But we only specialized in throwing like 2 million years ago, maybe less. So a human being was a brachiating animal for 20 million years, tree climbing animal for 60 million years, throwing animal for 2 million years. So throwing is natural to human beings, but it's less natural. Right? It's a newer thing. And because of that, our bodies are actually much more fragile to it. So then you can project this and say, how long have human beings been, hammering animals or screwdriver animals or, piano tuning animals? And then you see that people who specialize in professions that involve a lot of these repetitive actions, they develop lots of injuries because the structure didn't actually evolve in relationship to that. So this is a way that I like to think about natural and unnatural, or natural and artificial, is it's actually a spectrum of how adapted the organism is to something based on how prevalent that thing was over a prolonged period of evolutionary time. That makes sense?
Yeah, for sure. I
The
guess
center of our nature.
how do you use that same analogy then to relate it to other things that are going to means test a healthier human, you know?
Well, I guess I'll just go right to the deep end of the pool. We have different sexes. Those sexes have been around for like over 1 billion years. And they're selected based on the fact that one sex produces small, mobile, very cheap gametes or sex cells. One cell produces large, non-mobile, and very expensive sex cells. And so there's a fundamental asymmetry between the reproductive cost for females and males through every sexually reproducing species that has anisogamy. And that is older than trees. It's older than dominance hierarchies. It's older than tree climbing, is older than anything. So we are living in a culture right now that tells us that that actually is fundamentally unimportant to anything we experience about reality, that it's all socially constructed. And I think that is an incredibly deep denial of the fundamental nature of people that deludes us and guides us away from real self-knowledge.
But isn't there a difference between sex and then gender? Like how we see male and female contributing to society, I guess.
I don't think that gender is a valid scientific construct. That's a pretty radical position, but essentially the hypothesis of gender was generated in the middle of the 20th century at a period of time when in anthropology and sociology, there was an assumption of the blank slate, that human behavior was culturally constructed in toto, that everything about us, right, was socially constructed. So there's an assumption that there's behavior and then there's anatomy, and that they're totally unrelated except in how a given society decides that they should be related. But I don't think that's true. And in fact, I think we have mountains of evidence that it's not true. So we could say that there is anatomical sex, and then there's behavior associated with sex and sex role. And some of that behavior associated with sex and sex role is certainly socially constructed, right? Why do men wear pants and women don't in some cultures? In other cultures, men wear skirts or robes. That's socially constructed. In our culture, in Western culture, women wear makeup and men don't. But among the Wadabi and the Dani, men wear makeup and women don't. So which sex is the beautifying sex? Mm-hmm. So there's aspects of sex that are clear, or of sex role that are clearly socially constructed. But I don't actually think that we are cleanly able to separate out what is socially constructed from what is biological, because they're deeply, deeply intertwined. And we don't really have good, valid scientific means of sort of saying this is for sure a biological aspect and this is for sure not a biological aspect.
Sure. I think the need to identify as anything can be problematic, because what does that really serve? What's that? What's the objective there? To identify as something, just to get some validation of that you exist, maybe, or that your reality, coming back to how you see yourself, is justified. So I think if you're identifying as anything and needing it validated, that's a problem, because you living your life the way you want to is absolutely fine. As long as it doesn't impact on laws and you know, the things that harm people, then sure. But I think the problem is when people need to be seen a certain way and they need a stamp of approval. It's almost like that's the psychological problem that's happening. It's like people really are seeking, they need to be seen so much, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that roles and identities are sources of meaning for individuals.
Sure.
So if you're, you know, if you're on a basketball team, right, you maybe aren't the most skilled player on the team, but you are a great rebounder, and that can become your role. Right. Mm-hmm. Now you have a way of contributing to the team. You're saying, okay, we're getting killed on the boards. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to fix that. Right. If you are, you know, maybe you're an older player, you can't kind of keep up with the younger guys, but you're really good at offering them a little tip here and there, keeping the team up, keeping the morale up, keeping guys' emotions from going up and down. So that becomes a role. You have a veteran leadership. That's a role. And those roles give us a way to identify kind of how we can relate to the arenas that we're in ways that allow us to have meaning and to be successful. So I understand why people want identities, right? And that people need to have identities. My point in raising this is more around the idea of, if you don't know this fundamental aspect of yourself, you know, you started this with a quote about masculinity, right? Or men, right? Men's work. What is the theory that we offer young men about what it is to be a man and what it is to be a good man? And if we don't have a fundamental understanding of the nature of men, then we can't offer someone a meaningful guide to try to grow into that role. Mm-hmm. And I think this is particularly problematic because what our culture has adopted is actually a set of negative ideas about gender without any real positives. So we tell young girls that the defining characteristic of being a woman is not that they have the capacity to have children, right? It's that they are the oppressed class in history, right? That, you know, wearing long hair and skirts and high heels and makeup are all actually signals of being a subjugated class. And then on the flip side, we tell young men that the masculinity that they may aspire to, that may see in films, is actually toxic. And it is actually the product of a social construction of oppressive hegemony. So we have a negative theory of sex or gender norms and roles, but we don't really have a positive theory. We can't really say, what does it mean to be a good man? I I was speaking to a friend of mine about this. It's come up on my podcast a few times recently, but it's a good moment. He said, what is the difference between a good man saying someone is a good man and saying that someone is a good person, right? So what he's implying is maybe these are synonymous, right? The qualifier man tells you nothing about the goodness of a person.
Mm.
But I don't think that's true, right?
Well, I think on the same side of the coin is what does it mean to be human? And mm-hmm. to try and understand that primarily before you even think about what does it mean to be a good man? Because if you haven't got the foundation of what does it mean to be human and all the aspects that we talked about, mm-hmm. it's, if you haven't got that, then I don't think that you can start answering that question.
Mm. Yeah. That's probably true. And it's also true that one of the really fundamental things about human beings is that we are a sexed species, right? And actually a very dimorphic species, and not just physically dimorphic, but behaviorally dimorphic.
What is dimorphic? Much more,
two shapes.
Hmm.
So.
Speak for yourself.
So, elephant seals, the males are something like, I think like five times as large as the females.
Mm.
And they have these massive proboscis, these huge floppy noses. So very dimorphic. If you look at like gibbons, the males and females are approximately the same size and they don't look particularly different. So some species are very dimorphic. Some species are not very dimorphic. Another example would be like chickens, right? Roosters are very kind of fancy looking animals, and hens are much less fancy looking animals. So that's an example of dimorphism. So one of the things that is particularly interesting about human beings is that we have that by primate standards, we're quite dimorphic, especially when you account for body fat differences. So human beings are substantially less different in size than gorillas or even chimps, but we are really unique in how fat we are as animals, right? Chimpanzees vary in body fat between like 1 to 3% body fat, whereas like healthy human beings, males are around 15 to 20, females are 25 to 30. So it's a huge difference. When you account for the body fat percentage difference between men and women, human males are much larger than women, and much like we have 60% more upper body muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at something like hand grip strength, the strongest 5% of women are not as strong as the bottom 5% of men. Punching power is another thing. There's literally zero overlap between the male curve and the female curve.
Look at some
bone nuts. Yeah. So that's what we mean by dimorphic. Now, if you look at a species like wolves, right? Male wolves and female wolves do the exact same thing. They chase down big animals, pull them to the ground, rip them apart, right? Male wolves are a little bit bigger, a little bit more robust, but female wolves are very capable hunters, can easily hunt on their own. Lions, you know, famously people say that female lions do almost all the hunting. It's not really true. That's an artifact of how we study them, because it turns out that male lions only hunt at night because they have more of a heat burden because of their manes. But lions do most of their hunting at night. Male lions are substantially more capable of taking on the largest prey than female lions. But female lions are incredibly competent hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Like a siamang or a gibbon, they do exactly the same thing. There's no difference in their subsistence strategies. But if you look at humans in hunter-forager situations, what you find is that in virtually always, men focus on big game hunting and women focus on small game trapping and hunting and gathering, right? Mm-hmm. Roots, tubers, and berries and greens and firewood and stuff like that. So this is actually a really dramatically different thing about us, right? gorilla males do not do different kinds of subsistence than gorilla females. Chimpanzee males hunt and chimpanzee females don't hunt, but hunting accounts for maybe 3 to 5% of chimp diets.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a lot of cultures, 50% of the calories are coming from big game animals that men killed. So this is a dramatic, dramatic difference. It's really unique to human beings how different the subsistence strategies in hunter-forager cultures is between males and females. And I think it shows up in really interesting ways that people don't recognize all the time. In my household, my wife and my daughters come to me and ask me to take spiders out. Right? It's pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
That a spider is not a particularly dangerous animal where I live, right? We don't have any really dangerous spiders. But they find spiders icky, and they ask me to take them out. And I'm sure that there's people listening to this who are women who do the spiders, take the spiders out, men who are afraid of spiders.
Yeah.
But I bet if you polled people, you'd find that in most households, it's the men who take the spiders out of the house.
Yeah.
Because spiders are part of the class of dangerous animals.
Yeah.
And on a fundamental level, I have physical affordances that allow me to deal with dangerous animals more effectively. If there's a dangerous dog in the backyard, my size and the sound of my voice is far likely to intimidate that dog and get it to run away. So there's a dangerous human. Same thing. Like, that's all because we had this deep evolutionary heritage of men and women actually doing something very different day to day, and men be getting selected for a very different set of physical tasks. And so that's, to me, that's at the center of how you answer the question specifically and how you respect the nature of a human being.
Yeah. What would you say would be the reason that, I don't know, it's like 90% or close to in the West, I'm not sure where else, but how many women there are in education? Would you say that's kind of a natural approach? Because it's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's downstream of things about our nature, right? Because starting at around, you know, starting really before this, but especially around puberty, women just have a much stronger interest in young children than men do.
Sure. And also maybe women are more tolerant as well, because tolerant of pay, tolerant of, I don't know, but it's a pretty grim existence in the education system for a teacher. And it's getting worse. And all the people that I know who are very competent people have left. So it's maybe that's got something to do with it. Maybe men, you know.
Possibly. I mean, there's more people would choose careers that involve people in general if they didn't have to worry about money. But when it comes to a trade-off between money and the ability to work closely with other human beings and be of service to them, men are more willing to lose out on social connection in order to earn higher earnings.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, we know that that women are the teachers and the nurses, but men are the plumbers and the linemen and the deep sea fishers and the garbage men. You know, you're more likely to die as a garbage man than as a police officer.
Really?
Like 90% of the people who do that job are men. And they don't choose that job mostly because they're excited about being garbage men.
Mm-hmm.
They choose it because it's the quickest pathway to be able to make enough money to be a good partner to a woman and her children.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't value that. It just shocked me. Something I found out the other day was that the only other species, and I'd like to see if you know any different, the only other species that go through menopause and then still have many years left, because a lot of species that the female doesn't give birth, if that stops, then they just die. They just die out. They're just not needed. But is whales. It's orcas, I think.
I think that's also true in elephants.
Mm.
But it's very small.
they carry the tribe, and they're the wise ones.
Yeah, the grandma elephants are really, really powerful and influential in elephant societies, and we find the same thing in hunter forager societies. Grandmothers are very powerful.
Yeah, and that's just a testament to where we're at as a society, and what we value and don't, and what we don't have time for. It's kind of the aftermath, really. I'm wondering when that's gonna shift, how much we prioritize women's bodies and how they operate, because it's just tragic how we approach that collectively. When did this really all start feeding into your work? Were you always hungry to learn more about how the world operates, how the world kind of exists? Or did the movement inform your connection to start learning more about the environment?
Yeah. It's hard to say. I've always been a very curious person. I read every anthropology book in my local library by the time I was like 13 years old. I was fascinated. I've always had difficulty with subjects that people said, you shouldn't talk about that in polite company, right? It's like, oh, that's what I want to get interested in then, right? I'm on the big five personality characteristics, I am very low in agreeability and very low in neuroticism. So I'm not easy to sort of like push away from something. And I don't have like strong negative emotions when considering difficult things, right? So it's relatively easy for me to look at something like, sexual violence across different species and in human beings and across different societies. And I can look at that and be fascinated by it without it having a really negative emotional impact on me. So I think I've always had that. And then I also had a pretty chaotic upbringing in a lot of ways, where in particular, there were no masculine figures. There were no men that I wanted to aspire to be like. And so I think that that left me with a real hunger to try to answer the question of masculinity for myself, right? Like, how could I grow into being the type of man that I would want to be, the type of man that I would want to exemplify for my children and for people in my community? And then growing up in the communities that I did and seeing all the conflict between men and women, and then seeing the conflict between men and women that's part of the cultural war now, there's been this real desire to say, hey, like, what if we're like misunderstanding something fundamental that is making it impossible for us to frame this correctly so that we could actually come to like to solutions? And I think that a lot of times we don't like to look at nature. We don't like to look at the nature of ourselves because we find scary things there that make our most, utopian dreams seem impossible. So I think that the heart of my work has always been this fundamental belief that human beings have a nature and that we need to, I think of culture actually as a interface system between our nature and our environment, right? So the environment is changing all the time. And so the cultural technology that helps attune us to that environment has to update. So we are, for instance, what is the right way for men and women to meet and develop relationships? How does that change when we have smartphones and Tinder? Right? We don't know. I mean, like, some, without getting into gender and sex stuff, just what is the etiquette for how to contact somebody, right? Like, for young people now, it's rude to call someone without texting. And it actually makes sense. Like, I totally get that, right? I don't, like, I frequently text friends to say, when can we set up a call? Because I don't know what they're doing. And I don't want to interrupt them in the middle of something important.
That's radical for me. I just don't answer. You know, I just, most,
Yeah,
but
but I
most
don't like
people's
to.
phones are on silent anyway.
Yeah,
Because if
yeah.
it's not close to you,
Not,
then
oh, Jesus,
if it's
not
not
enough.
in, if it's not in your hand, then you're not free.
When you're with a friend, like it happened at the beginning of this call, I forgot to turn my phone off, my notifications off, right? And that's disruptive to the interaction that we're having. So I want to prioritize the things that are happening in person in my life, right? So it drives me crazy when I'm hanging out with someone who has all their notifications on. It was like their Instagram is popping off and their Messenger is popping off, and there's a million different. It's like how do we actually develop real connection in an environment where we're constantly getting these little sort of dopamine drips, right? So we need cultural technology that guides us. How do you respond to that?
Sure.
And
Do you think
that
that
takes time.
comes from within now? Because a lot of things external and we can't really look to culture. I mean, I certainly have, yeah, it's hard not to, it's not hard to be impacted from something, but I don't look to culture anymore. I don't look to newspaper, you know, people that are, let's say, have more of a voice in our culture. I don't look to them anymore. I look to, yeah, the people around me that I've connected with in a space like on a retreat, like, and make agreements with those people about, okay, so when we're with each other, we're not on our phones. Like, we'll just make an agreement because we have tendencies as a human, we have a
Yeah, so I
subconscious.
mean that's culture happening, right? When you and your friends get together and say, "Hey, we've all noticed that the quality of our interactions is lower when we have our phones turned on," you're creating culture. That's adaptation happening to the environment that has shifted. It wasn't a problem in the past. The problem we face is that as technology accelerates, the environment that we experience changes more and more rapidly. And so then the cultural adaptations that worked for, you know, the early era of the internet start to break down once we get smartphones. And then we have to adapt a new thing. And then the next generation is maybe, you know, maybe half the things you send to somebody are actually AI chatbots. Now you have to adapt to that environment. So I don't know the answer. It's like one of the central problems. I think part of it is that we need to really, really deeply investigate the idea of our own nature. And we need a new epistemology, something that places us in proper relationship to the rest of the world. And I think that we need to really deeply reinvestigate and reintegrate the wisdom traditions of the past. This is something that I've been kind of working on with John and folks around him, is how do you solve the problem of a more rapidly changing culture? And one of the answers is that, like, you need to kind of find the highest order principles for wisdom. So if you look at, you know, say the wisdom tradition of Christianity, the wisdom tradition of shamanism, the wisdom tradition of Taoism, the wisdom tradition of, you know, of Sufi, right? Within any one tradition, maybe you end up like unable to kind of determine what of this is sort of helping right now, and what of it is, you know, doesn't offer me a lens that I need to solve this particular kind of problem. But perhaps in having some kind of you know, John's metaphor right now is the philosophical Silk Road. You could extract the most important higher order principles. So we see this in motor learning theory. If you let's say you're shooting a basketball, right? And then you go and you throw a baseball and you throw a football and you throw a medicine ball, throw a punch, swing a mace. Now, each of these tasks will have a certain set of coordinations that allow you to do them well. But there'll be some aspects of those coordinations that are actually central to each, that are shared by each one. And by exposing yourself to all of them, the motor system then has a higher order key coordination principle to donate to the next similar task that comes up. And so it can start to organize from that motor principle down and then adapt off of it. Creates a kind of template for attunement to a new motor problem. So we, by exposing ourselves to a variety of different problems in movement learning, basically doing lots of natural movement, lots of play, lots of high variability, we can create an organism that has the capacity to more effectively begin to solve for novel problems. And the hypothesis is traditions exist for a reason, right? They're experiments that worked in some sense. But they worked for environments that were stable for maybe a long period of time, but are no longer stable. And so there's some aspects of them that are going to be stable in the new environment. So it might be the case that, like, if we that we got to go read the Bible and the Tao Te Ching to understand and then think about what they tell us in relationship to our smartphones.
Sure.
Yeah. It's the beginning of an idea.
Did you learn anything new, or do you feel like you just get reassured of, or just more direction on how to, it's just more of a refinement of how you're living, your virtues and it's more inspiration than actually a direction.
I mean, I feel like I learn new things all the time, but it starts it,
to get into... in relating to the Bible, let's say. So learning old traditions, mm-hmm. Do you feel like you have better frameworks to work from?
Yeah. Yeah. I was reading Corinthians 13 last night, right? Love is gentle, love is kind. There's nothing particularly new in that for me, but it sort of it's a beautiful symbolic system to interact with because it evokes things and it kind of the significance of it shifts. You come back to it, you come back to the text at a different time in your life, in a different context, and something else is revealed to you in it. You know, I have the same experience with Tao Te Ching, right? You can just read the first stanza of the Tao Te Ching, over and over and over again, and be like, oh, okay, that helps. That makes sense. That helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're weaving this into your daily life now. What about your kids? How are you, bringing them up? Do you need to do much or just model and just keep diving in?
I mean, I was very like anti-spiritual when my children were being born, really, because of the wounds of the childhood that I grew up with. And so my own explorations of sort of some of these things have been very internal and, mostly exemplifying them. Recently, I've started praying, I've been praying as a Christian. It's a new change for me. I've been inspired by the story of Christianity for a long time. I've been inspired by the ideas of it. But I have not chosen to actually engage in prayer.
Yeah.
And so I've been praying. And my oldest daughter is 11. She doesn't like Christianity. But my younger two children have been asking to pray with me.
Mm-hmm.
So
has this presented any challenges in your work? Has anyone treated you or approached you differently since learning that you've starting to read the Bible? Because that often can happen, right? It's got a lot of, got a lot of baggage. Or even speaking about it, like how does it feel in your body to speak these things out into the public?
Right now I feel okay with it. Like I, you know, I've kind of been fairly open with the idea, with my sort of uncertain relationship to Christianity for quite a while now. You know, I've had conversations with Paul Vanderclay and Jonathan Peugeot and even John Verbeke, where, you know, that topic has come up a lot. And I feel like I can hold it in a way that doesn't feel too threatening to most people. There, I've had friends who really don't like it, you know, or like, this is bad stuff.
Yeah, man, it can illuminate certain challenges that people have had as growing up, maybe, where I was at C of E school and there was stuff there that I didn't agree with, but it felt more.
CRV?
Oh, sorry, C of E, so Church of England.
Church of England, okay.
Not that you would know that. But yeah, and it was, it just felt like there was lack context. It lacked, in my personal view, like adults embodying what they were, speaking about or standing for, because you hear them, it's just like they're playing a role, you know, they're not really living that life. What about Ben Greenfield's work? Because he's definitely gone way more down that route of Christianity.
Has it?
Yeah, it happened a couple of years ago.
I met Ben a few years ago at PaleoFX, and I followed his blog for a little bit, but I have not actually done any deep dive on Ben or what he's doing or spent time with him in the last, you know, six, 7 years.
Yeah, he's devouting his, I'm sure he's devouting his podcast to that work. And he's really deep in it, and it's probably caused a lot of friction with people, with him interacting with his audience. And it comes a time where you have to choose, I think, if you want to go deeper into it.
I mean, the main body of my work, Evolve Move Play, I want to very intentionally hold in a non-denominational space, right? Like, I think it's something that can be an ecology of practices that serves you very well, no matter your religious background or lack of religious, you know, religion. So I do see, of course, some continuity between what I'm striving for in these arenas. But I'm not looking to sort of turn my work into proselytizing.
Currently, who knows? It's powerful though, isn't it? I don't have a stance, but I guess it's the same flavor as taking any political stance. It's just trying to keep it as, you know, away from those things as possible. Like, it has its own identity, right? Without getting wrapped up into others, I guess.
Yeah, I also, you know, have a big problem with the dogmatic, you know, Christianity that I experienced growing up, you know, like in the 90s and the early aughts, like the predominant Christianity, evangelical, sort of in your face young earth creationism that we experienced in the great new atheist wars of the message boards. It is not a particularly pleasant association for me. And that has certainly stood in my way of sort of recognizing the aspects of Christianity that are really, I feel deeply called to. So I certainly don't want to sort of flip and end up in a place where I'm, you know, replicating the very patterns that, you know, I'm trying to go to an integrated space, right? Like, I don't think that, like I said earlier, I think that I do think that you kind of, like, John talks about, it was C.S. Lewis actually had this analogy that the mere Christianity was like a hallway, and that each denomination was like a door, right? It was like a room. And you couldn't live in the hallway. You needed to choose a denomination and live within it. The hallway united all of them, and understanding the hallway was really important. And John's project of the Philosophical Silk Road is sort of expanding that idea of a hallway beyond Christianity to, you know, maybe the sacred in a more broad context. And he's sort of offering this idea of Zen Neoplatonism as a sort of universal grammar of the sacred that could be accessed by people in all of these different places, but that most of the people who access it are need a home, right? And for a lot of people, maybe that's Christianity. You know, a lot of people around John have been moving towards Christianity, which he's not, which is pretty interesting. But, you know, do you focus on sort of getting really like, I have to find this home, and then I have to defend it, and then I have to shut the door to everything else because it needs to be defended? Or do you focus on like, I'll have my place that's my home that I go to, and I'll also work in a way that's going to expand the commons. And I think that that a lot of conflict has been caused in our culture and, you know, throughout time by the first orientation. And so it's not one I'm excited to pick up.
Yeah, for sure. That is wisdom, isn't it? Just to know that the sword or the text or the book, or it holds a lot of power. And then comes the responsibility to do that. But yeah, I think it's important to have a roadmap of sorts. I don't really particularly think it's important which one it is, but whichever one feels good for you. It's yeah, if I could bridge that gap for people, I think it is important in a world which, you know, we could talk about the existentialism that is ensued in our culture and contributes obviously to the lack of meaning that people have, or the grounding that they have, or connection to their place, which really is the common thread between all religions. It's connection to the place, and having something that grounds that. There was a question the other day that I saw somewhere that it was, is it important to have gods? I think it was Advaya, actually. People in UK will know who that is. But there's this webinar on, like, is it important to have gods? And do you think we worship them anyway without feeling like, or being so direct?
Carl Jung said that there are no atheists. There are only people who don't know the God that they're worshiping.
Yeah.
This is an argument Jordan Peterson has made as well, which is, and obviously he's hugely influenced by Jung, but he's sort of couched it in the language of ecological psychology, or he's structured an argument in the language of ecological psychology. The reality is that we are interacting with a reality that is infinite, right? At least functionally. It's far beyond our capacity to attend to everything. So we have to organize our attention. So in some sense, there has to be, you're always prioritizing and always making a hierarchy in what you attend to. So right now I'm trying to attend to you in the conversation we're having. Now there's also freeway noise if I try to attend into it. But if I spend a lot of my attention there, I'm not going to be as good a conversation partner. So there's really no ability to act in the world without having a priority schema. And if you play that out across many iterations, across many different local games, the thing that organizes your perception consistently is something like the sacred. It's something like the highest principle that you have, right? So when we take away God, what we end up with very frequently is some lower order good that people end up worshiping without noticing that they're worshiping it. So you may have met people who are religious CrossFitters, where everything about them and their identity and everything they think about the world is somehow influenced by CrossFit.
Yeah, they'll bring it in every conversation. They'll talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. What's the old joke? How do you know someone's a CrossFitter?
Yeah, they'll tell you.
It works for vegans too. Maybe works for carnivore diet people, works for any number of people. So one thing that, you know, the deep, you know, traditional Christian tradition tells you is the same thing that the Taoist tradition tells you, is that the highest good is something that we can never grasp fully. And that's a really powerful realization, that the thing that we should be orienting ourselves to is actually beyond our capacity to fully understand. And that that invites us into a position of humility.
Mm.
And a position of respecting the mystery of existence. And that's a very powerful thing. Mm. So I think that we need to recognize the prioritization of attention and how it acts like something like worship, and that therefore we need some theory of a transcendent good. And that doesn't mean that you have to accept that, you know, like, I don't believe in Sky Daddy, the big white beard and a white robe, right? And I, you know, I think that people have a very shallow view of what we mean when we say God. But I think in some sense, we are already dealing with what in traditional Christianity is called powers and principalities, and that the Cartesian worldview and the postmodern worldview have done us a great disservice by not giving us a category to understand those things. John said in one of his recent conversations that about AI, and the most important science going forward is going to be the science of theology. Like, what are gods like?
Mm.
Like, we can imagine a god as a kind of collective intelligence that we are all in some sense dependent on, right? And this is not supernatural, right? We can see this happening right now. When you access Twitter and you see a feed of everyone responding to Taylor Swift at the Super Bowl, and you feel some emotion about it. Oh, this is dumb. Who cares about this pop starlet, right? Oh no, everyone's rooting for the Kansas City Chiefs. I'm a 49ers fan, right? What you're accessing is a kind of gestalt of a whole world, right? Not the whole world, but Twitter is a big chunk of the world. And you're accessing it through a algorithm that nobody understands, that is very intelligent, right? It's not conscience, but it impacts the world causally in really important ways and has a lot of intelligence in it. And so Twitter's a god, and Google is a god, and YouTube is a god. And if, or it's a power, it's a principality, it's a demon, an angel, right? Whatever word you want to use for it. But cognitive science is very clear now that there's something like collective intelligences, and that we're, you know, we are voluntarily, you know, essentially doing the most intense form of invoking of these powers every time that we log into social media.
Mm-hmm.
So a epistemology that's barren of the category of godlike beings is actually very diluted in the current environment. So that's my reaction to that.
Mm, yeah, what came up for me was happiness is a byproduct of living a meaningful life. So when I have meaning,
mm-hmm.
when I'm connected to what I'm doing, it just brings me joy. It brings me happy. It brings me happiness. Mm-hmm. When I'm of service, it brings me happiness. When I see people move from pain to purpose, or when they find meaning, it's a byproduct of that is it brings me joy. And I think it's inherent in our, and then it gets me thinking, well, why aren't more people doing this if it brings me so much joy and connection? And I don't want to open that kind of worms up, but it's, you know, do people firstly feel like they deserve it, like to be happy? Do they know their patterns and their blocks and their all these things that feature? But for me, it's always been that North Star of, okay, meaning, of course, meaningful life, happiness, sure. And then what comes with that is, well, what brings me meaning? And as I said, it's being of service. I was going to say something then. I can't remember what it was. I've lost it. That might come back. But yeah, it's to do with the meaning that there really is in the unknown, and surrendering to the unknown is really a pathway to finding meaning.
Yeah. So what comes up for me in relationship to that is, why do we fail to orient ourselves towards connectedness?
Mm-hmm.
Eric Fromm, I believe, was a philosopher who coined this idea of modal confusion. We have having needs and being and becoming needs. So hunger is a having need. You need to have food. And then when you satiate it, you don't need to have food anymore. Sex is a having need, right? Mm. An urge, you can meet it in any number of ways. You can have sex. Now, being in love is not the same as having sex. And it's not something that's simply satiated. It's something that unfolds out as we invest ourselves in it. But we make a mistake. We think that if we have lots of sex, that we will experience the connectedness of a true love connection. And so we mistake the having mode for the being mode. And I think that I think capitalism is a really great system for organizing markets, and that we don't have any replacement systems, but it's a very bad God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that too many of us have actually collapsed down to capital as God. And so we have these sort of maybe three gods of money, freedom, and pleasure. And all of those things are things that we want to have. We want more freedom to travel the world, to have, you know, the access to whatever. We want more pleasure from food, from sex, from drugs, from social media credit.
Mm-hmm.
And we want money to be able to access these things. And because it's the thing. And then we don't realize that actually we can have enough of those things, and that beyond enough, they don't contribute to our happiness. And the being parts are what truly make us happy in the long run. And within our work at Evolve Move Play, we've really come to the conclusion that there's sort of five fundamental dimensions to connection that we need. The first is the connections internal to the self, right? How do the different aspects of your psyche integrate? Your anger and your self-criticism and your love and your self-awareness, right? How does your shoulder coordinate with your hip, right? What is the somatic meaning of shoulder tension for you? That's the internal relationships with the self. The second is the self to the world as a landscape, as a place we move through. When you practice parkour, you open up a whole new set of affordances of meaning in relationship to the world. Then there's the world as a set of things that we can manipulate, objects. When you have a craft, when you can cook, when you can make things, when you can take care of a car, That's a whole set of meanings that are available to you. You have real relationships now. And then there's the relationships you have to other living agents, other human beings, other animals. That's an incredibly important thing. How connected are you? How deep is that? And then the last is the transcendent. What is your relationship to the forces that you must be humbled in front of?
Mm.
How aware are you of that? How well do you integrate with that? How does that impact how you act in the world? And if you can invest yourself in a college of practices that helps you attune those relationships, we believe that's the pathway to falling more deeply in love with the experience of being, which is ultimately happiness and meaning. So that's probably a good place to stop. That's the thesis statement of my work. True.
You've solved it. You solved the meaning crisis. Yeah,
I hope I've given.
Yeah, it's an important framework. I don't think you can have connection to other things if you're not connected to yourself.
Yeah.
I think that is first and foremost. That's the theme of the podcast, really. It's the connection to you first, how you feel about yourself when you're by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
There's a Buddhist book I read called Elephant Dung. And I didn't get much out of it, but there was one quote. This guy was sitting on a bus with a, you know, Buddhist sage. He asked him something, you know, like, what's the most important thing in life? And he said, to care for the person that you're with. And then he said, but remember that most of the time, the person you're with is just you.
I love that.
There we go.
Yeah, I love that. Because you automatically assume, I say to people, we're going to work on relationships today. And then no one expects that to be the relationships themselves. Like, who in the room thought about the relationships themselves?
It's a big one. It's the start for sure.
Yeah, man. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chris.
Appreciate it. And yeah, I will direct everyone where they need to find out more about you and John and all the things you're bringing into reality over there. Have you still got places this year on events?
We do, yeah. We have a few places left for the retreats. So if people just go to the link in the bar in the bottom, they'll find my retreats, and we'd love to see some of your audience there.
Yeah, beautiful. And when are you coming to the UK?
I don't have any plans to come to the UK this year, but my student Ben Metter will be teaching in the UK under I believe. And my student Charlie Holt will be teaching under his own brand, Roots of Play. But we also have EMP events coming up in Copenhagen and Cologne, taught by Ben.
Yeah, nice. You'll catch him in Hampstead Heath and
yeah.
Chaz Motions, isn't it, on Instagram?
Yeah, Chaz is great.
How's he? Is he still with you?
He just left yesterday for 2 weeks up in Canada. He's doing a Sistema intensive and then spending a week with another one of my assistants while I'm away. I'm doing some intense internal work, so I need a little space. But Charlie will be back with me on the 10th and we'll be back at it.
Nice. He's just intensive hopping, isn't he? Love it, bro. Thank you for your time, man. And enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks for listening, people. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel. This is the best zero cost way to support. If this podcast is providing you value, please get further involved by donating as little as £3 a month over at my Patreon. If you do this, you will get free bonus content, invited into a private WhatsApp group, and jump on monthly calls to dive in to topics covered in recent episodes. Of course, only if you want to. In addition, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening and leave a 5-star review. This helps the podcast tremendously. Or send it to a friend or someone you know will benefit from this episode. If you have any of the questions, comments, or people you'd love me to get on an interview, or even topics you want me to cover, please say so in the comment section over at the YouTube channel, link in the description. Please check out the sponsors I mentioned at the beginning, two brands who I wholeheartedly support, World Soul Sandals and XL Coffee. for discount codes, links are in the description. There is also a link in the description where you can subscribe to my monthly newsletter, where I share musings and info about events and discounts. If you want to share any episodes, please, please do so over at Instagram. Tag me in your stories, the.chris.geisler. Thank you for your interest in conversations to help us all remember ways that once served us and redirect us back into connection with ourselves and the places we go.